The news media recently have launched an all-out attack on an organization that promotes the family, the biblical way. The family order ordained by Yahweh is under attack, it seems, from every direction. The assault is most intense right at the top. The feminist movement wants women to take charge in this world, not only charge in politics, business, and everywhere else, but also in religion, as well as the family. You know, I can't understand it. I just can't understand why isn't the woman's job primarily raising the children, raising the next generation, important enough? That's what's going to change society or keep it the way it is. I believe most women would be content in their given role if the feminists didn't constantly harp at having them do something else, convincing them otherwise and make them feel like second-class citizens if they aren't out there asserting themselves and trying to take over. I also believe they'd be completely happy in their role ordained by Yahweh if men fulfilled their roles as Yahweh commands men to treat them. I want to look at the way the designer intended, designer with a capital D, intended it to be from the beginning over in Genesis chapter 2. Here Yahweh opens the scene with Adam sitting there by himself, looking around, unhappy, lonely. His life is unfulfilled. He needs company. He needs a helpmate. Verse 18, Yahweh said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make an helpmate for him." Out of the ground, Yahweh formed every beast of the field, every fowl of the air, and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. So he's busy there naming all the animals brought before him, kind of like Noah, you know, collecting them all, giving them a name. Adam gave names to all cattle, the fowl of the air, every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found an helpmeet for him. He is still not happy. Tried to find a companion maybe among the animals. He wasn't fulfilled. So he caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he took one of his ribs and made a helpmate. Made woman. Now remember which of our original parents, Hasatan, came to in the garden when he tempted Eve with the world's biggest and first temptation. You, Eve, can be wise and powerful. Powerful is Yahweh. The battle was over before it even began. She took the bait and swallowed the hook without a single question. Hardly. Why do women spend billions and billions of dollars on cosmetics, on fashion, on beauty? Because of the same kind of pulls that were evident here in Eden. The desire to be somebody. And it's not just women. Men have the same desire. It didn't help that she was seduced by a glorious being, a superhuman intelligence. He purposely chose to make an end run around Adam and to work on the weaker vessel. Work at the foundation and topple the whole thing, see? He knew very well how to destroy this perfect marriage relationship that Yahweh had established as the first family. He knew how to do it. Pervert the hierarchy. Challenge the leadership. Take over. Sounds like some congregations I've been in. This whole scene is trivialized and almost cartoonish by the translators who suggest that she spoke to a snake. The Bible strongly indicates that Satan manifested himself quite differently from a talking serpent dangling from a tree branch. Satan is typically described in the word as what? A being of immense beauty. A magnificent being. Forget the horned guy in the red body stocking holding the pitchfork. Let's turn to Ezekiel chapter 28 and see if this looks like Yahweh is talking about a snake. Ezekiel 28, start with verse 11. Moreover, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus, and say unto him, Thus says Yahweh Elohim, Now we're establishing a strange mixture here. We find three analogous subjects in this chapter. It's speaking, first of all, about a king of Tyre who represents a satanic antitype. Then we have Satan himself, as well as references to the Antimessiah in this chapter. So we've got three in one, and we've got to distinguish and separate them out. He says, "You seal up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty." Now, this isn't any individual I've ever seen. This is somebody special. This is a unique individual. "You have been in Eden, the garden of Elohim." Well, I know Tyre, the king of Tyre, hasn't been there. "Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, topaz, and the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, and the carbuncle and gold. The workmanship of your tabrets and your pipes was prepared in you in the day that you were created. You are the anointed cherub that covereth, and I have set you so. You were upon the holy mountain of Elohim. You are in Yahweh's kingdom. And you have walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. You are perfect in your ways from the day that you were created. And just like in Genesis, till iniquity was found in you." We had paradise until iniquity caused sin. Is this looking to you like Yahweh's talking about a snake? Here we find a glorious being. And isn't it interesting that the same scheme Satan used on Eve, that you can become as Elohim, the same ploy, the Antimessiah. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is deceived by two. Let's look at that. It happened at the start. It's going to happen again at the end. 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 3. "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed," that's the Antimessiah, "the son of perdition," the son of damnation or destruction, "who opposes," notice, "and exalts himself above all that is called Elohim or that is worshipped, so that he as Elohim sits in the temple of Elohim, showing himself that he is Elohim." The same ploy that destroyed the harmony in Eden is going to again afflict this world in the end times through this man who sets himself up and wants to be Elohim. We see the king of Tyre and the Antimessiah demonstrating that same characteristic desire of Satan to hijack the authority of Yahweh, as well as possessing the attributes of Satan himself. Back to Ezekiel 28. Verse 12, Satan is personified as a being of beauty, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. Now notice, verse 13, "You were in the garden." He was beautiful. I believe he appeared to Eve as an angel of light. The Hebrew word is nakash, meaning a shining one. The reason it came to be translated serpent is because it also means, has the connotation of to hiss and to mutter. Let's look at this for a minute. Turn to Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. See, he came to Eve and he said, "Hey, Eve, I've got a plan. Forget the plan you heard. I've got one better. You can be like Elohim himself. You can be like the Most High." Hey, walking around in a garden is nothing when you can rule. You can be great. Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. "Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast." And that really is that beast, living creature or being, is where it should be. See, everybody got the mindset of a snake and everything, so the translation is really garbled. "Of any being of the field which Elohim had made, and he said unto the woman, Yea, has Elohim said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent," the being, the nakash, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, or the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden. Elohim has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. So here we have the temptation. Temptation. Nakash, from the root, meaning to shine, a shining one, comes to Eve with a proposition. In Chaldee, it means brass or copper because of its shining. The word is cognate to Neshutan, a piece of brass that we find in 2 Kings 18:4 that Moses put on a pole. You know, we always think of a snake. It's talking about a piece of brass, some kind of image there. In the same way that seraph is also translated serpent in Isaiah 6, 2 and 6, it means a burning one. A burning one. Let's look at that, Isaiah 6. And it, above it stood the seraphims. Each one had six wings. With twain he covered his face, and with twain he covered his feet, and with twain he did fly. And one cried unto another and said, holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts, and the whole world is full of his glory. And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Then I said, woe is me, for I am undone, Isaiah says, because I am a man of unclean lips, and dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, Yahweh of hosts. Then flew one of the seraphim unto me. Now it's interesting. King James translators, you know, I am in Hebrew is plural. They got a double plural here. They added an S onto it. And that's just because they didn't do their homework, as in many other places. Having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken from the tongs from off the altar. Seraphim, a burning one. And because the serpents mentioned in Numbers 21 burned by reason of the poison of their bite, or because of their bright burning color, they were called seraphim or seraphs too. A bright burning being. Can you see the connection? Numbers 21:6. I think when we start to see what Eve was up against, we can start to understand. Yahweh sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. The serpents are the burning ones. The burning ones is Haserfim. In verse 8, Yahweh said to Moses, make you a fiery serpent and set upon a pole. Fiery serpent. He said, make you a Nakash. The same thing that Eve faced in the garden. Moses made a Nakash of brass. It's used interchangeably with seraph, you see. In verse 6, it's seraph. In verse 8, it's Nakash. It's a shining, burning representation of something great. If seraph is used of a serpent because of its shining, burning nature, and is also used of a celestial or spirit being, a burning one, why should it not be used of a serpent because... Or why should it should be used of a serpent? Because its appearance was shining or bright and burning, like a celestial being. You see, this is the mind of the translator working. The Nakash beguiled Eve, 2 Corinthians 11:3. What's it spoken of there? 2 Corinthians 11:3, Paul says, but I fear lest by any means as the serpent beguiled Eve through his subtlety, so your mind should be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Messiah. Again, translation difficulty. Verse 14 says, and no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Oh, are we talking about a serpent or an angel of light? A burning one. Every example in Scripture talking about Satan himself is a majestic being. Why is he a snake? A glorious shining being, apparently an angel, seraph-like being to whom Eve paid such deference, acknowledging him as one who had superior knowledge, superior wisdom, superior beauty and glory, was not an inferior being like a snake. Moreover, in the description of Satan as the king of Tyre, it's implied that the being was of supernatural order when he's called a cherub in Ezekiel 28:14. A cherub. You were in Eden. You were in Eden, a glorious being. He says in verse 16, by the multitude of your merchandise they have filled the midst of thee with violence, and you have sinned. Therefore I will cast you as profane out of the mountain of Elohim. I will destroy thee, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Seraphim and cherubim, I think there's a song talks about that, who are in the glory of Yahweh, these angelic beings. Same thing Hasatan was created as. One of the most perfect, if not the most perfect and most beautiful beings Yahweh created in that order. Over in Ezekiel 28, there's more about the king of Tyre than what you can find is literally true about the prince of Tyre. Now we're talking about two different things. We're talking about a human king, but we're also talking about Satan as the prince of Tyre, who is the prince and power of the air, we know. These words that we read can only be understood of the mightiest and most exalted supernatural being that Yahweh created. And this was to show how great would be his fall. So Yahweh contrasts the two. Subtle, in Genesis chapter 3, means wise. Wise. Verse 1. He was more subtle than any beast, any being that Yahweh created. Wise. Hebrew Arum. Any living being that Yahweh had created. More wise than that. So, I mean, Eve didn't have much of a chance, did she? Very innocent. All she was told was, don't eat of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, that tree. That was a simple command, but she was all confused by this Nekesh. Because he was more wise, and he knew exactly how to work his wiles. I have a hard time conceiving her as being deceived by a snake, a talking snake. But we can understand being her fascination with an angel of light possessing supernatural knowledge. That we can understand. That same weakness that caused her to sin, to succumb, exists in all of humanity. Yet, it was not by deception that Adam sinned. Adam was not deceived, was he? He sinned because she persuaded him to follow her. Genesis 3:7, he took it upon himself to go ahead and do what she told him to do. Verse 6 says, the woman saw that the tree was good for food, it was pleasant to the eyes. Well, he told me it would be. This whispering, beautiful, bright being. She took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and did also give to her husband with her, and he did eat. And the eyes of both of them were opened. They were opened. 3:17 says, unto Adam he said, because you have hearkened unto the voice of your wife, and have eaten of the tree which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it. Then he says, you're going to have problems from here on trying to eat, period, and raise food. You're going to have problems with weeds, drought. You're going to be the poor farmer subjected to the whims of the weather. You're going to have trouble. Out of love for his wife, no doubt, he went for it. She probably looked at him, you know, batted her eyes, put on the charm maybe, and then he melted. Men may be characterized in Scripture as the stronger sex, but they can often be putty in the hands of women. Just ask Samson, you know, what he went through. What was the line in the fat Greek wedding? The woman says she doesn't need to be the head. All she has to be is the neck. She can turn his head in any direction she wants if she's the neck. Paul explained in 2 Timothy 2:14 that Adam was not in the transgression. 2 Timothy 2:14. I'm sorry, 1 Timothy 2:14. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression. Oh yeah, he transgressed too. But the ball was already rolling, you know. Let's go back and look at the man-woman-husband-wife relationship, the way it was intended to be before human sin fouled it all up. Let's go back to Genesis 2. Genesis 2 and verse 18. We started there. Yahweh said it wasn't good that man should be alone. I'll make him an helpmate. So he created a helpmate for him. Out of his rib. We read that part. Then, verse 23, Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his wife and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. And they are both naked." By the way, that word is a homonym to subtle. Isn't that interesting? Same spelling as the word subtle, just as Satan was subtle. "And the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed." There was no reason to be. They were in their bedroom. There wasn't anybody else. But still, after they sinned, their eyes were open. They became ashamed. Here's a perfect relationship. He had no problem accepting her, even though he had just met her, basically. She was literally part of him. Not only was she part of him, but they were one flesh in both figurative and literal sense, having been made of his rib. You know, Yahweh's design is incredible. In any close relationship like we find in the family, there is one who must lead and the others who follow. In a relationship of two, you can't have two leaders. It doesn't work. It will not work. In a relationship that's close like a family, it won't happen. It won't last. There'll be nothing but strife and division. But as Yahweh designed it, the family, it works beautifully according to the way Yahweh has set the man first and the woman to help. And it's a beautiful thing. Bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. Taken out of me to be one flesh with me. This is a glorious union. This woman, her submissiveness is willing and it's beautiful. And the man's provision is willing and it's beautiful. And there's no animosity. There's no struggle. There's no fighting. There's nothing but a perfect beauty, glorious union. He designed marriage for the simple reasons to produce children, to be fruitful, multiply, he said, to eliminate loneliness. Adam was very lonely. His life was unfulfilled. It's not good, Yahweh says, for man to be alone, to have physical fulfillment. The union of Adam and Eve was for both his and her physical fulfillment. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 says that Yahweh has designed each man to have his own wife in order to fulfill the physical as well as other emotional and spiritual emptiness that each can work on to fulfill. And to have enjoyment, to share life together. The wife helping her husband where and when she can to help the family be a success. You know the Proverbs 30 woman who's out there just working away. He designed marriage as a union that fulfills and brings happiness to everyone. And when the family is happy, society is happy. What do we got now? We have an attack on the family. Society isn't happy, is it? Society is a mess. And it's getting worse. Talk to somebody at work who isn't particularly religious. But she's concerned, she said, about her family in the future. And says, I'm telling my kids, I don't know how it's going to be when you come to raise your children. She could see it. An old joke says the first sport in the Bible was tennis, where Moses served in Pharaoh's court. But actually, that's false. We find the first sport over in Genesis chapter 26. Here, old King Abimelech's looking out a window, and he sees Isaac. What's Isaac doing? Verse 8. It came to pass when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of Philistines, looked out the window and saw, and behold, Isaac was sporting with Rebekah, his wife. Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, of a surety, she is your wife. How did he know that? Well, they were somehow intimate at that point. I don't think they were doing anything that's untoward, because it obviously it could be seen. But, you know, maybe hugging, whatever. You don't do that normally if it isn't your wife. So he knew something was up, and we know the rest of the story. In Yahweh's design, the husband and the wife have a physical union. The two have become one flesh. And if the male doesn't make it happen, it's not going to happen. Again, the man is naturally a leader. So Yahweh made this beautiful relationship where the woman, who was to be the helper, was wonderfully supported to the man. And the man, who was to be the head, was wonderfully loving to his wife, because she's part of him. I mean, as the scripture says, who wants to hurt his own body? That's stupid. It's ridiculous. I mean, you don't go out and start hacking at your hand. Unless you've got something wrong. The feminists who argue this arrangement make it out to be some kind of repressive, controlling evil on the part of the male. Can you know one day just take it up with Yahweh if they want to? These rebellious, unruly, insubordinate feminists can stand before him one day, and in his breathtaking majesty and in their insolent defiance, try to explain to Yahweh the way it should be. And when they're cartwheeling through the air toward the nuclear flames of the lake of fire, they can think for a brief instant about who really is in control. Who really makes the rules for his creation? And then they can, you know, scream their pathetic wails and be silenced forever. And Yahweh will once finally have the way it should have been, his plan from the beginning. You can't pervert Yahweh's divinely ordained arrangement and expect to get away with it. Someday, everyone will pay for their sin. It was all right with the world in paradise until something awful happened in Genesis chapter 3. Something terrible happened. Hasatan approaches Eve and proceeds with an attack that was nothing short of pure genius. He bypasses the headship of man. He goes right to the one who is by nature the follower, the helpmate. He goes to the emotional one, and with his extreme beauty and smoothness, he enchants her. The woman ends up usurping leadership in this incident, and the man, in turn, takes up the role as the follower, turning Yahweh's design upside down. He does what his wife tells him. He takes the fruit. And from that point on, our situation as human beings was sealed. Sealed in concrete. And the curse was on. The woman was to have pain in childbirth. The beautiful situation of childbirth and the beautiful wonder of it is going to be mitigated a little bit because of the pain that was going to come with it. To remember to not defy Yahweh's arrangement. And when Adam sinned, he also had to suffer to get out of this earth the food would not be an easy thing. Adam was going to have to suffer. And when he sinned, his death passed on all men. Death also happened to this world. In Adam it says, Romans chapter 5, we all sinned. So that is what's happening in our day to day. That's why we see the struggles we have because of sin that entered in. Now, you look at human society today and people don't seem to want to admit that the reason there's conflict in marriage is because there are total reversal of roles that came about in the sin of the beginning. There's a constant battle for control. Yes, there is chauvinism. No question about it. The world is full of it. And it's been around throughout history. And that's part of the curse of sin. And yes, there are those who would usurp the power of Yahweh. That's also the curse of sin. So brethren, you see there are two things needful if you're going to have a marriage that works. The woman has to go back to the place of that beautiful submission she knew before the fall, and the man has to get back to the place where his commitment is simply in love to take that woman as if she were one with him and render to her every single thing that he would do for himself. If that would happen, our whole situation that we see in our society would do a complete turnaround. In other words, we need to go back where women are characterized by their role of helping and men are characterized by their sacrificial love, just like it was before the fall. It's not natural. You know, think about it. It's not natural to love someone. It's not. What's natural is to love yourself. The Bible talks about it all the way through. It's natural to be self-consumed. It's natural to be self-occupied, self-absorbed. And as long as you're like that, you can't love another person. So the institution of marriage has been sullied by the first sin, to put me up on top. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, Satan starts taking shots at the marriage too. So you add to the basic curse in human nature, you add what Satan does, and you're going to have problems. Look what he does immediately. As soon as sin enters the world, Satan begins to attack marriage. He's going to try to crush it as best he can because he knows that it's the only hope of right human relationships. He's going to devastate the world by devastating the relationship that's most important, that's the foundation, the most important, to attack the home. So this is where we are, attacking the home. We come to chapter 4 of Genesis, and what do we see? What do we see? I'm going to show how Satan is relentless. And through this book, he is, you know, they say once you, if you're in a fight, once you get the guy down, don't give up. Don't let him back up. Keep on going until he's completely subdued. And Satan is doing the same thing here in Genesis. We come to chapter 4, and what do we see? Verse 23. Lamech had his wives, Adah and Zillah. Oh, he had wives from A to Z. Adah and Zillah. Wait a minute here. What are you doing with two wives, Lamech? What do we have here after the fall? We've got polygamy. Immediately, prostituting the divine standard. They two shall be one flesh. That was Yahweh's standard. Immediately, Satan does what? He introduces polygamy. Now, that's not enough. Let's go to chapter 9. Satan's still at it. He's trying to corrupt the wonderful marriage union that Yahweh has established. Chapter 9, verse 20. Noah began to be a husbandman. Oh, he's going to be a farmer. I mean, he's going to start, you know, raising food, man of the ground, what the Hebrew indicates. So he sets himself to tilling the ground. He planted a vineyard. And he planted a vineyard, and then he drank of the wine and was drunken. And he was uncovered within his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and went backward, didn't look at him, and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. What did he do? Doesn't really say. Doesn't say exactly. The implication is that he at least really looked at him for a while in not a right way. And then he went and told his two brothers outside. So we have introduced for the first time evil sexual thoughts and words, no doubt. Because Noah knew something was amiss. Adam and Eve, before the fall, were not ashamed for being in that condition. Why? Because there were no evil thoughts. There couldn't be any perversion of any kind. But after the fall, we start seeing all these things coming in. And they went out and covered themselves. Sin entered. Evil thoughts came in. Perversion became a possibility. And here we find it. Right here in the 9th chapter. Shem and Japheth knew better than to whatever Ham did. They took a garment and covered their father up. In the next text, it says that because of that, Yahweh cursed Ham and blessed Shem and Japheth. So Satan has now introduced what? Polygamy, chapter 4. Evil thoughts, or maybe worse, chapter 9. Chapter 16, Yahweh says to Abraham, you're going to have a child. You're going to have a son. And that son is going to be the beginning of the progeny of the race of people through whom will come the great deliverer of the world. Yahweh gives this promise to Abraham. At this time he's called, of course, Abram, who doesn't have a son. He says to Sarah, we can't have any children. Sarah, what are we going to do? So in verse 2 of chapter 16, Sarah said unto Abram, behold now, Yahweh has restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto your maid, that may be that I may obtain children by her. Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarah. Abraham hearkened to the voice of Sarah. And Sarah, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband to be his wife. And he went in and she conceived. And from that point on, the history of the Middle East has been sealed. Because most believe and most scholars can accept that the son of Hagar has been the progenitor of the Arab nations, which have given the sons of Abram, who has received the blessing, problems from that point on. So here we have, essentially, adultery. Sexual relationship with someone outside the marriage, another way to destroy. It wasn't long after this, you come to the 19th chapter of Genesis, and you meet something horrendous. Something we see coming on the scene everywhere today. Everywhere, it seems. 19th chapter Genesis. Satan has already introduced polygamy, evil thoughts, adultery, and now homosexuality. Chapter 19, two angels in the appearance of a man come to visit Lot in verse 4. For they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round about, old and young, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot and said unto him, where are the men which came in to you this night? Bring them out unto us that we may know them. Of course, a euphemism for having relations with them. And Lot went out at the door unto them and shut the door after him. And he said, I pray you, brethren, do not do so wickedly. He's even telling them that what they're about to do is going to have extreme ramifications. Behold, now I have two daughters. You may have them, but don't touch these angels. He doesn't call them that, but he says, don't touch these men. For they've come under the shadow of my roof, and they said, stand back. And they again said, this one fellow came in to sojourn, and he will needs to be a judge. Now will we deal worse with you than with them. Who are you? Arrogance. Arrogance of these men. What do we see today in our world? The sin of sodomy takes over, and what do you have? You have arrogance in your face. In your face. We are proud the way we are, and we will march down the road in your big cities holding signs and showing how perverse we really are, and we're proud of it. That's what we see right here. The same thing. Stand back, you judge. And they pressed sore upon the man, even Lot, and came near to break the door. But the men put forth their hand and pulled Lot into the house to them and shut the door. And they smote them that were at the door of the house with blindness, both small and great. Did that stop them? No, they're still feeling around trying to find the door. Get at these guys. Still at it. Till they wearied themselves to find the door. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. The word, of course, no, is loaded with meaning, and it means they wanted to have relationships with these men. So they kept beating on the door, even though they were blind, and Yahweh finally sent fire and brimstone and destroyed entire cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, it's tough enough to make marriage work. But when you add all these other things against it, we see what we see in our society today. You see all of this going on. The evil that Satan has introduced that's influencing people everywhere. Genesis chapter 34. Well, Satan isn't done yet. Oh, no. He's not through. Genesis 34, we have some more coming on. 34 verse 1, and Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her, and he defiled her. Fornication. He defiled her. So here's another evil that's been introduced. Remember, we're not even out of Genesis yet. Notice how Satan is just corrupting the human stream in rapid fire succession, one after another. Polygamy, evil thoughts, adultery, homosexuality, fornication, and probably rape in this case. Go to chapter 38, you find another perversion. It's one our society hasn't really indulged in openly yet, but I'm sure it's next. Verse 13, it was told Tamar, saying, behold, your father-in-law goes up to Timnah to shear his sheep. She put her widow's garments off from her and covered her with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the open place, which is by the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown and she was not given unto him to wife. That's his other son. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot because she had covered her face. And he turned unto her by the way and said, go to, pray you, let me come in unto you. For he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what will you give me that you may come in unto me? And he said, I will send you a kid from the flock. And she said, wilt thou give me a pledge till you send it? And he said, what pledge shall I give you? And she says, your signet, your bracelets, and your staff. And so he did. And she conceived. So we've got a form of incest going on here. Relationships within a family. And Judah thought she was just a prostitute. What was he doing? So She had a price. She said, well, give me your personal effects. And he did. Prostitution, solicitation, incest, all in one incident. In the next chapter, you find Joseph in Potiphar's house and find an illustration of seduction. No wonder people have such trouble trying to make marriage work today. The attacks against it started from the beginning, didn't they? Against the family. Derailed from the start. And if that wasn't bad enough, we live in a society that extols all the evils as desirable because our society's leader is Hasatan. He's still at it. He hasn't given up. In fact, he's going full steam ahead. He's really working now. You can hardly stand to turn on entertainment anymore. Turn on the TV, listen to music or the radio, or watch most movies. They're all filled with it. All of these sins are blatantly displayed for all to see, including and especially children, the next generation. I sometimes wonder why the 50 to 60% divorce rate isn't more like 95% in a culture that hardly knows the Bible and is constantly bombarded with all of these things and people thinking it's good. You know, it's tough to live in this world. I do weep for the next generation. I don't know what's going to happen. It's tough trying to keep Yahweh's precepts in the midst of a wicked and perverse nation and to keep a righteous home. Satan smashes man at the very core of his greatest need, a blessed family. You want to have a meaningful relationship? You want to have a marriage where a wife submits lovingly to her husband, to his care and protection and headship, where a husband lovingly, self-sacrificingly gives himself to her in every way, then get in line with Yahweh's way. Get in line with his precepts. Learn from the Creator. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Here we have in Ephesians chapter 5 the way that Yahweh has established it. The way Yahweh set it out. Begin with. Paul picks it up and explains it to the Ephesians. I don't know what kind of problems they were having. It seems like Paul spends most of his time, if not all of his time, dealing with problems. Problems here, problems there. Why? Because people simply refuse to submit to Yahweh's way. So you're going to have problems. And even if you do, you're going to have problems in this world because there's the rest of them that are not. So, you know, it's a constant struggle. Paul said he fights a fight. Every day he gets up in the morning, gets ready to fight a fight, puts on his armor, puts on his shield, and grabs his sword, puts on his helmet. Because he knows he's going to fight a fight every time, every day. Something is going to hit him. Ephesians 5:22, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto Yahweh. For as the husband is head of the wife, even as Messiah is head of the assembly, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the assembly is subject unto Messiah, everybody is subject to somebody, right? Yahshua is subject to his Father. We're subject to Yahshua. No one, no man on this earth, no human being is truly in charge of anybody if they're not subject to Messiah. Therefore, as the assembly is subject unto Messiah, let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Then he says, husbands, you've got a mandate yourself. Love your wives, even as Messiah also loved the assembly and gave himself for us, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. He's then making the analogy with the assembly and the way it's set up, that he might present to himself a glorious assembly, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loves his wife, what? Loves himself. Loves himself. For no man yet hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, even as Yahweh or the master does the assembly. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother, shall be joined to his wife. Husbands are commanded to honor and love their wives. I remember a minister once saying, well, women are commanded to love their husbands, or men are commanded to love their wives, but women are supposed to honor their husbands. We know that the young women of the assembly were to be taught to love their husbands too. And at the moment the reference escapes me, but you know, it works both ways. Love is a two-way street. But if you want a happy relationship, just start getting involved with the way Yahweh has laid out the plan. Start abiding by his word, and you'll find that things work. It's a beautiful thing. Too often, we're too busy looking at the world. We're looking at psychologists. We're looking at poll takers. What does everybody else think? I don't care what everybody else thinks. Brother Ken and I were talking the other day. That narrow way is a lot narrower than we really think. We don't care what the rest of the world does or thinks. It doesn't matter. Oh, we'd like them to get in line with Yahweh's way too. But, hey, each of us is to work out our own salvation, aren't we? So let's get in line with Yahweh's way and leave the world to its own self-destructive habits, because that's what's ultimately going to happen. We know it's going to happen. It's prophesied to happen. But Yahweh's people will one day rule with him and teach the right and honorable way that was set up in the book of Genesis before everything went south and before man decided to take control and not honor Yahweh as being in control. May Yahweh bless you.